This is a special edition of the Reaction podcast, and I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. On the 6th of July 2021, we hosted an event at the famous Garrick Theatre in London with Professor Neil Ferguson, one of the world's leading historians. In conversation with me, he discussed his new post-pandemic book, Doom, and the state of global politics and economics. It was recorded in front of an audience of Reaction subscribers. Here's the recording. I hope you enjoy listening. Welcome, Neil, and welcome back to Britain. It's fantastic to not be doing this on Zoom.
Yes.
We've had various conversations.
I can't mute you.
Exactly. You can try. You spent the first phase of the crisis travelling and writing about what was coming, and then headed for rural America, complete remoteness, and I think in Montana. That is a whiskey. How was it for you there? And then why this book? What prompted this in this sort of rural vastness? You settled down to write something called Doom. Why?
We're doomed. I can't help feeling there's something slightly funny about two Scotsmen sitting talking about doom in the West End. It feels like the beginning of one of those jokes Dave Allen used to tell, if you remember. That was why I suggested we have whiskey in honour of Dave Allen. We should also be smoking, but that is almost certainly not allowed. I was already thinking about writing a book about disaster before the pandemic struck. I'd become conscious as an historian that I didn't think enough about potential discontinuities caused by technology. And so I started manically reading science fiction, which I hadn't done since I was a teenager. Mm. I'd given up science fiction at about the age of 17 to be serious and read only history. And then in 2019, I started to feel antsy that history was giving me a lot when it came to thinking about the future, but there were things missing. So I started binge reading science fiction. And if you do that, whether you're reading Margaret Atwood or Liu Cixin, pandemics feature rather a lot. It's one of the common ways in which humanity ends. In fact, the original first true dystopian disaster novel is Mary Shelley's The Last Man, which is about a plague, which leaves just one guy. So I was thinking a lot about that and trying to persuade my publisher, unsuccessfully, to let me do a book about the history of the future. And I was getting some strange looks, it must be said, in New York restaurants. Similar to the strange looks I got in 2006 when I tried to persuade Channel 4 that they needed to do a television series about subprime mortgages. So I have a certain intuition about these things. And in January the 3rd last year, I get an email from my old friend Justin Stebbing saying something funny about this new pneumonia in Wuhan. Mm. And that was the first red flag. And then the red flags became more and more frequent. Chinese Communist Party denies human-to-human transmission. At that point, I was absolutely sure there was human-to-human transmission. And meanwhile, I'm flying around the world, because that was my lifestyle in those days.
Helpfully being a super spreader.
I was actually not quite possibly it, but, yeah. A super spreader. Probably not. I've been to look back on it, and it was a little bit tempting fate. I was in Asia. I was in Taipei. I was in Hong Kong. I was in Singapore. Then I came back to the World Economic Forum at Davos. And everybody at Davos, I don't know if you've ever been there, but they're all wandering around the conference center. Climate change. Greta Thunberg was there. There was some guy called Trump, whom I vaguely remember, was there. And it's all climate change. And it seemed like I was the only person there convinced that there was a pandemic underway. There were actually delegates from Wuhan on the list of conference participants. I'm frantically emailing Klaus Schwab, who runs the World Economic Forum, saying, do you realize climate change is a very serious issue, but this is actually happening now. There's a pandemic, not in 50 years, but now, and there probably are people with this virus here now. But that convinced me that I had to write this book. But I didn't want to write a book about pandemics. I didn't want to write a book about this pandemic or just pandemics. I wanted to write a book about disasters. The key organizing idea of Doom is that, like Tolstoy's Happy Families, all disasters have certain common characteristics. And I wanted to write that book because there wasn't a book that brought all disasters together between, you know, one set of covers. Mm. Cheers.
So the pandemic hits. I can remember, I think it was the night of, I was going to say the night when people were celebrating Brexit, the night when Brexit was being marked.
which I think was the 31st of January. And that was the first time that I was conscious at a party that people were, even then, avoiding shaking hands. And a noted biologist, Matt Ridley, indicated that he thought it was serious. But it hits, when it hits, why are so many people really surprised?
There's this extraordinary phenomenon, which I think has to do with our individual and collective psychology. We are told again and again and again that a certain kind of disaster is going to occur. And there were certainly multiple predictions of a pandemic, almost as an annual event. And it was an annual TED Talk. It was Bill Gates 1 year and then Larry Brilliant another year. So we had endless warnings. I even found that I'd written about it in a book called The Great Degeneration. And yet, when it happened, it turned from being what some people call a grey rhino, the thing you see lumbering towards you across the Serengeti. When it actually arrives and it's there and the horn is about to go through the chest, it's a black swan. And we're all amazed, stunned at this unprecedented event that nobody could possibly have foreseen. And I was interested in that cognitive quirk, that something multiple times predicted is suddenly very surprising, and of course unprecedented, which is a word that journalists use to mean, I've not done any history. So I wanted to kind of write a book that showed that it was very, very precedented, and that we have something of a track record as a species of being surprised by disasters that have been repeatedly predicted. In fact, early in the pandemic, in about March, I suddenly was struck by how like the outbreak of the First World War it was. Because the First World War had been predicted ad nauseam. I did a book about this many years ago, The Pity of War. There are endless predictions of a great war that's going to come in Europe. There are even novels imagining the German invasion of the United Kingdom and of Regent Street becoming Regentstrasse. This is all repeatedly discussed. But when the war actually breaks out at the end of July, beginning of August 1914, everybody's stunned. And it's described as if it's a bolt from the blue. So for me, the outbreak of the pandemic was oddly like the outbreak of the First World War. And then I thought, you know, why not compare those things? Why are we assuming that there's one set of books about wars, which are man-made disasters, and another set of books about plagues, which are natural disasters? And I wanted to write a book that discarded that dichotomy and said, actually, all disasters are fundamentally political, whether they have their origins in a diplomatic decision or their origins in a novel pathogen, because it ultimately is about human agency, how many people end up losing their lives prematurely. And that's a really important idea that I borrowed from Amartya Sen, the great Indian economist, who said of famines, that famines are not natural disasters, that they are actually political disasters that are a function of human agency. And my insight, which I think is an original one, is that that's not just true of famines. It's actually true of all disasters, including this one.
Yeah, you talk about the spread of the pandemic being connected to our modern networks. I mean, you think of air travel, globalization, human social networks, tourism. Were we particularly susceptible to this, particularly exposed because of globalization?
Yes. The last book I did was called The Square and the Tower, and that was an attempt to explain network science to a history reading public. To explain that to understand most historical phenomena, you have to have some handle on contagion. And to understand contagion, you have to understand not only the thing that's going viral, but the social network that it attacks. This is a really important insight, because I think we're inclined to assume that a contagion is all about the pathogen, or it's all about that piece of fake news that goes viral. But that's only half the story. The other half is the structure of the social network that it attacks. And we had created, mainly through air travel, but not only, the ultimate contagion machine by the end of 2019. There had never been so many direct flights from Wuhan. There were direct flights from Wuhan to San Francisco, to London, to Rome, to Paris. There had never been such volumes of passenger traffic. So at the heart of the argument of the book was the idea that this was a networked disaster, and all the big disasters in history have this element of contagion. I mean, most disasters are local, but if you have a big enough disaster, there can be contagion. That's even true of volcanic eruptions. If it's a big enough volcanic eruption, it'll actually affect the entire atmosphere of the Earth. And so my sense was that I had to capture why some forms of disaster have this character of contagion. Another point, which is really important, Ian, we had two pandemics last year and into this year. One of them was the pandemic caused by the new coronavirus. The other was the pandemic of disinformation and misinformation on the internet, which made it really difficult for policymakers and public health officials to communicate to the public, because the public had this extraordinarily tempting array of crazy stories that were very engaging, which was why they were getting promoted on Facebook. But those crazy stories included quack remedies and, of course, anti-vaccination arguments, which I think have ultimately been very damaging. So, yeah, for me, it's very important to understand network structures. You can't understand what a super spreader is, for example. This is a term we never used to use before. Now it's become standard. But to understand what that means, you actually have to understand how a social network works and how it is that one woman in South Korea could spread the virus to thousands of other people by her very gregarious behavior.
There's also an assumption, isn't there, in the era we live in, that medical progress and scientific progress has made us much more resilient to threats, that we're more resilient just because we're cleverer, and what did people know in the past? Steven Pinker and the psychologist from Harvard and Martin Rees, the astrophysicist, made an interesting bet on this basis, which you refer to in the book. What was it?
There's this wonderful thing in San Francisco called the Long Now, which is one of these things that brings together computer science people and natural science people and a few quirky historians like me who are interested to talk to those people. And they have a kind of website in which people place bets about the future. And years ago, I forget exactly when, I think 2004 or 2007, Lord Rees, the Queen's astronomer, bet that by December the 31st, 2020, an act of bioterror or bioerror would claim a million casualties, at least. Now, that bet sat there, largely unnoticed, until my friend Steve Pinker, the Harvard psychologist, decided to take the bet. And he accepted the bet. Wisely for him, I think they only bet $700, that Rees was wrong. And so I came across this bet and thought, how fantastic. I love bets, by the way. I'm not personally a betting man, but I love when people formalize a bet. It's a great way of testing. If you're having an argument, you know how people like me and Ian are always arguing. Oh, Brexit's going to be a disaster. No, it's going to be great. Well, have a bet. And then write it down, because nobody ever honestly remembers the terms of a bet. So you must write it down. By the way, one day there's a fantastic book to be written, maybe by somebody in this audience, on the betting books of Oxford and Cambridge colleges, which are a fantastic resource, telling you what people thought was going to come. And I remember coming across in the Jesus College betting book bets on when the Soviet Union would be invaded by Nazi Germany. And there must have been one fellow working for British intelligence, because he got it almost exactly right. But you're betting on the future. It's a great way to test whether your handle on the future is right. So this was a beautiful bet. Steve Pinker then wrote about it, I think in his book Enlightenment Now, saying, of course, the great advances in medical science mean that all the pandemics that have been predicted over the last 20 years have not happened. Ebola was never a pandemic, dot, dot, dot. And it's a wonderful moment because ultimately he won the bet in the nick of time. Remember, the time frame of the bet was specified, and that should always be the case. You can't have an open-ended bet. You have to say, by the end of 2020, a million people or more will have been casualties. And the phrasing was important, bioterror or bioerror. Mm-hmm. Now, Lord Rees is a lovely man. He's far too nice, because of course he's won this bet. But he emailed me the other day to say that he wasn't prepared yet to take the money from Steve Pinker, who, being a Harvard professor, will never admit that he was wrong. It's a very important feature of Harvard professors. They are never wrong. But in truth, it's a no-brainer. I mean, they didn't even say deaths, casualties. Comfortably a million people were casualties of this virus last year. And, I mean, the death toll is already close to 4 million. It's probably higher than that. And the terms bioterror and bioerror seem to me crucial here.
Because we don't know yet, definitively.
And that's why Martin's not taking the money. But in truth, it's almost certain to my mind. Not, we can probably never be sure, but it's almost certain that this was a lab leak. I'm more and more sure about that. Because why else would the Chinese be covering up the events of January and indeed of December 2019? It must be because there's something to hide. And the wet market story looks less and less plausible. I was finishing the book about a year ago. I couldn't really be clear then, but it looks more and more likely that this really was a bioerror that occurred because they were conducting research into bat coronaviruses and there was a leak. It's highly plausible to my mind that that's what happened, in which case Lord Rees is owed $700,
absolutely.
No question.
Well, what do you make of the media's handling of that? Because you had a story there which was shut down for a long time. I mean, I'm agnostic on it. I've read both sides, I think. It's clearly complex, confused, not sure yet. I don't think there's a verdict in. But it was actively shut down by not just by tech giants, but by large mainstream media companies that decided, because Trump had said, it's a lab leak, it's China, it's China. China did it. There was then that was conclusive proof that that was not the case. Therefore, the story needed to be shut down as misinformation. It was a really quite chilling experience.
You've touched on a really incredibly important point. I think the power of the network platforms, the big tech companies, is a huge problem that we have failed to solve. And it was a huge problem visibly in 2016. And the United States, failed to address that problem in a meaningful way. With the result that increasingly after Trump's election, these companies used their enormous power to engage in an increasingly politically skewed censorship. And this is an extremely dangerous thing, because if one's to try to work out what the origins of a pandemic were, you can't shut down lines of inquiry and say that's off limits. And that's what happened. And those people who pursued the lab leak hypothesis, I think, deserve great credit, because they were pursuing it in the face not just of editorial hostility, but if you pursue something like that and Facebook decides that, or Twitter decides to cancel you or take your account down, that has meaningful consequences for any public intellectual. So it illustrates the danger that we've created for ourselves. As I said, this parallel danger in the public sphere, it's not only that we're susceptible to contagions of fake news or extreme views, but it's the fact that in addition, the network platforms can control the spread of true news, or at least plausible hypotheses. And in the end, science is just about plausible hypotheses and trying to find out if they're wrong or not. If we start ruling out certain hypotheses ex ante, we basically walk away from science proper.
And then these companies have very strict rules on essentially three strikes and you're out for publishers.
Right.
And that decision is taken in a way which is very different from the kind of old world of media, or in UK terms, I know the US is different, but in UK terms, Ofcom regulation. There is no court of appeal, really, with big tech. So what's the logic then? What should we be doing?
Well, of course, there's the Supreme Court of Facebook, which has been created by Mark
Is this Nick Clegg's
Zuckerberg.
Thing?
I don't know whether he's a judge on the Supreme Court of Facebook, but in Zucker world, this is, of course, one of the many sops to public sentiment that are basically meaningless. I mean, you have to remember that Mark Zuckerberg's hero is the Emperor Augustus.
Yeah.
It's never a good sign if your hero is the Emperor Augustus, by and large. If your spouse begins to talk about, I'm so like Octavian, don't you think? Do call the doctor. But he's built an enormously powerful empire. In some ways, it's more powerful than any previous private corporation, because it combines this tremendous dominance of one market, this market for social media, with almost untrammeled power. Remember, there is no real regulatory control over Facebook under a peculiar piece of legislation that nobody here has probably heard of, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, a mid-1990s piece of legislation designed when tech companies were quite small, which is kind of the catch-22 of the tech world, because it says if you allow some harmful content to appear on the platform, it's not your fault. On the other hand, if you engage in an act of, I'll call it censorship, or just call it editorial intervention by shutting down discussions of the lab leak hypothesis, that's okay too, because the First Amendment doesn't apply to you. You're a private corporation, and you can make up your editorial rules. So basically, Facebook's a tech platform when it wants to be, and it's a publisher when it wants to be. And that's a fantastic catch-22, which explains the enormously profitable nature of these businesses. They have almost no legal liability. You can't sue them for publishing harmful content, and you can't sue them for censoring you. That's the problem that the Square and the Tower identified. I tried to write about this in the British press. I remember doing a piece for The Spectator about this. I remember saying, back in 2017 or 18, it's Trump versus Silicon Valley. That is the real contest of our time. Who won? You know the answer, because Trump was entirely cancelled just after January the 6th of this year on all the platforms, by Amazon as well, which entirely closed down his alternatives to Twitter. He was cancelled while he was still the President of the United States. And to me, that's a truly amazing thing. When people say there was a coup on January the 1st, they're thinking about the rabble that were allowed to storm into the Capitol, but the real coup was against the president by the social media companies. Hmm. And everybody thought it was okay. It was like, great, hooray, they've canceled the President of the United States. And that's the way so many Democrats think. They don't ask the question, could that ever possibly happen to us? It's always awesome it happened to that a-hole Trump. I'm as disturbed by that as by anything that's happened in the last 18 months. And what really disturbs me is the kind of acquiescence, the celebration of the fact that the President of the United States was entirely taken off the media.
Mm. So where does this lead us to in terms of regulation? Because is it likely that the political class on either side of the Atlantic is going to make a good job of either breaking up these companies or imposing regulation that actually works? What will it look like?
Well, what will happen, I think, is that Europeans will continue to generate regulation because they don't have any tech companies, and therefore they do regulation. That's been true for some time now. The United States is going down the blind alley of antitrust, trying to break up Facebook. And these cases will last a very long time, and they will lead, I think, probably nowhere. I mean, I can't see Amazon significantly falling foul of that process, because how are you going to show that Amazon hurts consumers' interests, which is the fundamental test still in American law? You'd have to persuade the American judiciary to rethink antitrust, which I don't think can be done. And in the end, even if you do take Facebook and you force Mark Zuckerberg to give up WhatsApp and Instagram, you haven't fixed the fundamental problem that these companies now dominate the public sphere in a way that no newspaper proprietor, not Rupert Murdoch, not William Randolph Hearst, no previous publisher had anything like this kind of power. And I find it slightly chilling that we are so content with this. At least Americans seem ultimately content with this state of affairs. And the Democrats have clearly made their peace with it. Republicans noticed, but too late, that Section 230 was a problem. But by the time they started talking about it, Josh Hawley did, for example, it was too late. They'd run out of legislative road. And the Democrats are only too happy to kick this into the long grass of antitrust because it serves their short-run interests to have big tech on their side. And in the end, big tech decided Trump could not possibly be allowed to do again in 2020 what he'd done in 2016. And that too came to pass.
Is he going to run again?
Probably.
And probably win the nomination?
Probably, yes. I think you'd have to be very, very delusional to think that he has lost his base. It's still there. It's still there. And as long as he is able to reorganize, regroup, he has a very plausible case to make. A lot of the things that were said about him, going all the way back to the Mueller inquiry, have not stood the test of time.
And you mentioned the case of the lab leak hypothesis. There are other things too. So my sense is that American politics is sleepwalking towards a Trump revival that will be very troubling for the political elite, which would very much like him to go away, but I don't think he will.
And the circumstances in which that happens, presumably that is then powered by what's happening on the ground in terms of crime, which American voters are particularly concerned about rising as an issue because it's happening, and the sort of woke dimension of things as well. So that culture war plus crime equals a Trump revival. What happens? What about the midterms?
Well, it's hard to know because there are so many cross currents here. Economically, the US is on fire to the point that Larry Summers, who used to worry about secular stagnation, is now worried about inflation. Paul Krugman, my old enemy, ran a column this week, mourning in Biden's America. You know, they're really hoping that the economy propels them to success. I think they might well be disappointed for the reasons you've just mentioned. The crime wave in American cities is real, and it originated in the protests of last year. There's a major crisis of policing that has followed from the protests that followed the killing of George Floyd. And if you look at the data, and I was looking at it earlier today, it's really startling. There are surges in homicide in most major cities, but also surges in other forms of violent crime. If you think back to the last time this happened, which was from the late 60s through to the 80s, it was a huge political issue ultimately, and became a defining issue for Republicans. It hurt Democrats to be seen to be soft on this issue until finally Bill Clinton, and it should be said also Joe Biden, got on board with tougher criminal justice legislation.
Time.
And that wasn't until the 90s. So I think it's very important to watch this because it's a big issue, not only in the cities you kind of read about, but it seems to be true in most cities where protests happened. Yeah. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is that the inflation issue will not necessarily celebrated by ordinary people as a success. The Fed will be saying, hooray, we've finally got inflation back above 2%, but I'm not sure that's going to be popular. Well, and then you talked about the woke issue, and I'd say the culture war issues are crucial to understanding Trumpism. The reason that Trump won was not really... It was partly economic, but I think it was as much cultural as it was economic. And if you think about what's going on here, the ideas of the progressive left, whether it's critical race theory or their line on transgender rights, or you pick a topic, those ideas are deeply at odds with what the majority of ordinary people think. And the more that is pushed, especially the more the Biden administration goes with it, I think the better the prospects are for a Republican revival. The problem for the Republicans is, if that revival is once again going to be led by Trump, they will have a profound problem. Because in the end, he's a damaged brand. I mean, that's why he lost.
But the process, that process you describe unfolds in a different way in the 1960s, but it does, after all of the protests, the anti-war protests, the progressive upheaval, it results in Richard Nixon for similar reasons, because that was termed at the time the silent majority emerges. But Richard Nixon, for all of his flaws, is not Donald Trump. Donald Trump reborn is a much scarier prospect than that. What would he be like as president second time round?
I think it's important to reflect on how Trump went from bad to worse. One of the things I was struck
because
by...
Because we always thought that he would be normalised. So that
right.
was the assumption,
yes.
That he would become president, just the solemnity of the office, the morning intelligence briefing, and the guy would suddenly realise, right. Now, if I'm an actor, which is kind of what he is, I now need to act the part of president.
Right.
And he decided not to.
That's right. And there's a kind of curious recklessness there. Even in the handling of the pandemic, it got steadily more reckless. Trump's instincts at the beginning were not bad. I mean, the idea of the travel ban, if you think back to January of last year, it was Trump who wanted, on the advice of people like Matt Pottinger and Peter Navarro, to restrict Trump travel from China. That was January. Remember, in January, liberal commentators were still saying, oh, it's just the seasonal flu, and if Trump wants to do this, it's because he's a racist. That was being written in the New York Times and the Washington Post, etc. So Trump's initial instincts were not wrong, and when you think about it, the issue potentially played well for him. Here was something that was clearly China's fault. It made it clear that you needed to control your borders. For all kinds of reasons, COVID ought to have been a win for a populist president. But it unraveled, and I think it unraveled because he was strongly advised, and I won't say who it was, but he was strongly advised that if he took those actions that might have prevented the spread of the virus, the economy would suffer, and that would impact his election prospects. And this led to a series of tremendously costly mistakes in which he and others talked as if the whole thing would simply go away and be over by Easter of last year. By the time the closer he got to the election, the more reckless his behavior became, to the point of hosting super spreader events in the Rose Garden. And so as I watched this, and I felt this as I was writing it, there was a kind of self-destructive quality to it that ultimately cost him the election. I mean, if you are mishandling a pandemic that is disproportionately killing elderly voters who are crucial to your success, and by the way, having a peak of infections and hospitalizations in the key states he'd won in 2016, the key swing states. If you think back to what happened in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, they were having a particularly bad time with COVID in the run-up to the election. And so he became more reckless in the hope of trying somehow to salvage this by holding ever more rallies, spreading ever more viruses. And that's what makes me nervous of a Trump revival. We can see that this is not a man who grows into the job, who can assimilate into the way in which the government works. All the predictions people made in 2017 turned out pretty much to be wrong. And I shudder to think where he takes up when you reflect on the fact that he left off insisting that the election had been stolen. Now, I felt, and I don't know how you felt, Ian, and how others in the audience felt, I felt as soon as the networks called Georgia, it was over. If there had been one state in the balance, as had been the case in 2000, yeah, there was a fight to be had. But he'd lost multiple key states, as well as doing very poorly in the Midwest. The fact that from that point on, he and an increasingly motley crew of mavericks, not to say nutters, sought to contest the legitimacy of the result, that seemed to me pretty disqualifying. And I said that during the most heated parts of these discussions, on various broadcasts. So in a sense, I thought he'd kind of disqualified himself, but it doesn't look that way now. It looks as if he has a path back to power, and I think that should make all conservatives nervous, because he is fundamentally not a conservative figure. And that's, I think, an important point to emphasize.
Let's talk a little bit here about the politics of the crisis. It touches on Trump as well, but some governments failed, and others, particularly in Asia, did well. Why? What is it about some Western governments that dictated that we were bound to fail?
Well, the subtitle of Doom is The Politics of Catastrophe, and that's a central question that the book addresses. One of the things that really irritated me last year as I was writing the book was how many articles I read that said the reason we're having excess mortality in the United States, the United Kingdom, Brazil, India, is that we have a populist president stroke prime minister, and it's their fault. I mean, Jim Fallows wrote a piece in The Atlantic that said, it's essentially like being a president's like flying a light aircraft, and if the plane crashes, it's pilot error. And I read the piece and I thought, you've been around a long time, Jim. If you think being the president of the United States is like flying a light aircraft, retirement is calling you and you should take the call. Because being the president is nothing like flying a light aircraft. It's not remotely like that. In truth, and I think this is also true of being prime minister, you are, if a thing like a pandemic happens, you're heavily reliant not only on other officials, the elected officials who've been put in charge of departments or appointed to be in charge of cabinet positions, but you're also reliant on public health officials. You're reliant on people at the state and local level. It's not as if the president's job or the prime minister's job is to sit there and analyze the latest research on a novel coronavirus in preprints from Chinese scientists. So in truth, and this is a key argument the book makes, although the populist leaders undoubtedly made mistakes, it is implausible to argue that if they had not been in office, if Joe Biden had magically been president a year early, or if instead of Boris Johnson you'd had some other prime minister, it would all have been fine. And that's the implied counterfactual. In reality, the point of failure and disasters of this sort is not generally at the top. And that's a big and important part of the story this book tells. Often in disasters, the point of failure is further down the chain of command. And I learned this from a most unusual source. Some of you will remember when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up in 1986. I'm old enough to remember that. It wasn't a big disaster in terms of death toll, because 7 people died, the crew. But it was a big disaster in terms of its impact on public consciousness. And if you were around and you saw that thing blow up seconds after launch, it was a startling and shocking thing. The initial response of the Washington press corps was to try to blame it on Ronald Reagan, who was then president. And there was a great hypothesis that went like this. President Reagan wanted to mention the launch in the State of the Union address, so they rushed the launch, and that's why it blew up. This was a complete non-story, and it quickly died because there was simply no evidence. In truth, something quite different had happened. And this is something that came from Richard Feynman, an amazing and brilliant physicist from Caltech, who they brought in to put on the Commission of Inquiry. And Feynman was not the kind of person to take Washington rules and regulations. So he just wandered around NASA asking engineers what seemed like sort of dumb questions. It emerged that what had really happened in the space shuttle case was that the engineers knew there was a 1 in 100 chance the space shuttle would blow up. In other words, at some point it would blow up, because they were going to do at least 100 of these things. But there was a guy in the bureaucracy called Mr. Kingsbury who changed that to 1 in 100,000, which is quite a big difference if you think about risk. And Mr. Kingsbury is, to me, a fascinating figure, because I think he is everywhere. There is a Mr. Kingsbury in most organizations, public and private, who is the point of failure. It seems to me that if you look closely at the COVID disaster, the real point of failure is there in the public health bureaucracy, where people whose job it was fundamentally misunderstood the nature of a new and contagious coronavirus. They thought it would be influenza, it wasn't. And I had another epiphany when I was writing the book. I came across, thanks to my friend Philip Zelikow, a lecture given in 2018 by the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness. That was his job. A man named Cadlec, Robert Cadlec. Now, if your job is to be Assistant Secretary for Preparedness, you are presumably the person responsible for the pandemic preparedness plan. In this lecture, he said to an obscure audience in Texas, if we don't have a better insurance policy against a pandemic, we'll be SOL if there's a pandemic. Now, I didn't know what SOL stood for, being British. I had to look it up. It is shit out of luck. Excuse my profane language, but this is how Americans do things. SOL. This was the guy whose job was preparedness. He said, we're kind of whistling in the dark. And this is the Mr. Kingsbury moment for me. The guy whose one job this was knew that the 36-page pandemic preparedness plan was basically worthless. And if this reminds you of anything, it should be Dominic Cummings' testimony about what went wrong in London. Mm-hmm. Because it's a very similar story. On paper, the US and the UK have the best preparedness plans. They're ranked number 1 and 2 in 2019 by the Economist Intelligence Unit and the Johns Hopkins Survey, on paper. And I think what we really have to learn from this crisis, rather than to try to pin it on the person at the top, that the mid-level public health bureaucracy, and until we recognize that, I think we're very vulnerable to the next disaster being equally messy.
But isn't there an alternative history in which, let's take Boris for example, in which someone else is prime minister in that period, and what you were hearing in January, what was filtering out of China January, February, try and imagine, let's for the sake of argument say Margaret Thatcher, a scientist by training, or I think Blair less so, certainly Gordon Brown, prime ministers like that would have been absolutely all over it and calling and consulting in international terms and chairing meetings in February. And it's possible, isn't it, that asking those questions, is this plan robust? What happens if that number is wrong? Is our underlying assumption, what if this is not the flu? If that had happened, could history have been different?
Well, we know that there were some governments that got this right, and that's very important, because it would be unfair to pass judgment if everybody had done equally badly.
Yeah.
In Taiwan, which in some ways was the best performer in 2020, though they've struggled more recently with vaccination, the vice president was an epidemiologist. They also had a tremendous digital minister in Audrey Tang, and they did the right things, which were very quickly to ramp up testing and then to use contact tracing to prevent the spread of the virus. And they acted early. They did what Larry Brilliant says you're supposed to do with a novel pathogen: early detection, early action. Almost no Western government did that. The Germans did somewhat better than us, but one can't really say if only Angela Merkel had been prime minister, everything would have been great. Mm. Because in truth, at some level, there was luck involved too. There were fewer super spreader events in Germany in the early phase. In truth, Germany is less connected to Wuhan than England is. So I think the real counterfactual that interests me, which is in some ways not a counterfactual because it happened, is what if Obama had been president? We actually know what happened when there was an epidemic under President Obama, because there were two. The first one was when swine flu swept North America in 2009. Ron Clade is an interesting guy. He's actually the president. I know you think it's Joe Biden, but it's actually Ron Klain, who's the chief of staff. He's in fact the president. And Ron Klain said in 2019, if swine flu had been as bad as COVID, we would have had a public health disaster under Barack Obama. In fact, an enormous number of people were infected with that virus, including many, many students at Harvard where I was teaching. This was a virus that was very rapidly spread amongst young people, but it just turned out not to be that deadly. The other epidemic that happened under Barack Obama was the opioid epidemic. And there's actually less excuse for that because it didn't happen anywhere else. Each year under the Obama presidency, more people died of opioid overdoses. Each year it got worse. The total death toll from opioids under Barack Obama was about the same as the death toll from COVID under Donald Trump. And yet I haven't come across the article in which Jim Fallows says that the people who died because of the opioid epidemic were ultimately on the hands of President Obama. And that is because I think the narratives have got very skewed in the last 18 months. So I think we have good counterfactuals, and I don't think having a different president or a different prime minister would ultimately have produced a radically different outcome. And here's why. When you ask yourself, why was there quite high excess mortality in the UK and the US? Not the worst, because the worst was in Latin America and some East European countries, but sort of middle of the table in terms of excess mortality. Certainly worse than some Scandinavian countries. The answers are as follows. Failure to get testing to happen early on. That was especially bad in the US. That was the fault of CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. Secondly, no attempt at contact tracing. Still in the US, virtually none. Here it happened later, and it worked quite well, but it didn't really happen until late last year. Thirdly, and crucially, no effective enforcement of quarantine in the early phase. And finally, no protection of the vulnerable, which were the elderly in care homes. And wherever you look, it doesn't matter who's prime minister or president, those mistakes were the principal causes of excess mortality. And you're not telling me that those were decisions taken at the very top. These were all decisions taken much, much further down the chain of command, particularly in the case of elderly care homes, where you can see in the US it was state governors who really screwed up.
So let's talk optimistically, survival.
Oh, no. Not optimism.
The crisis is... I don't want to jinx it. It's not a crisis is over, but we're here in a theatre in central London. There will be greater reopening in the next couple of weeks. Let's try not to think too much about the autumn. But life is coming back, and it seems as though people are adjusting to the idea that they have to live with it. What will life afterwards look like? We have the vaccines, which is an extraordinary success story. If you'd said a year ago, well, actually on Moderna, as you were saying to me earlier, the pharma companies were optimistic very early on.
And
that's the case in the UK as well. But if you'd said right at the start of the crisis, we'll have these vaccines, I don't think people would necessarily have believed it. So we can get back to something like normality. You wrote recently for Bloomberg about some of the adjustments we're going to have to make. But reassure us, is it going to look more like normal life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think one has to contrast this pandemic with the much more deadly pandemic that we previously lived through, which was HIV/AIDS. Remember, that killed more than 32 million people. And there was never a vaccine. It took a long time to get to any medical treatment that could halt the advance of the virus to AIDS. So by contrast, this has been a less disastrous event, even if you believe the very large numbers that The Economist estimates the true death toll to be. The other thing that's a cause for optimism is the success of the mRNA vaccines. Remember, books are not newspapers. I had to finish this and sign off on the proofs late summer last year, and it was the last tweaks were sort of August, September. It wasn't clear that the phase three results of the vaccines would be as good as they were. I had to kind of guess how it would turn out. And I wanted to do that to show readers how history unfolds in real time. It's easy to forget when you read a history book that contemporaries don't know the future. One of the inherent problems with writing history is that the historian and the reader know how it turns out. They know the Germans lose World War II. But when you're writing history in real time, you can capture that contingency. At the time I was finishing the book, it wasn't clear how this would unfold. And so I offer the reader two scenarios. There's a bad one in which the vaccines don't work very well, which is a very, very bad scenario, in which we therefore have an ongoing AIDS-like problem. And then a good scenario in which the vaccines have high efficacy. But the key thing that really turned out to matter more than people a year ago expected was virus mutation. I think we've ended up in a kind of middle scenario where the vaccines have high efficacy, but the virus mutates in ways that we kind of underestimated. The good news is it's clear that there's going to be a significant wave of infections of younger people in the coming weeks and months. But this is not going to translate into high levels of hospitalization or death because the UK has made a huge success of the one thing that really, really matters in a disaster like this, which is vaccination. Mm-hmm. And we mustn't forget that after all is said and done, both the US and the UK governments last year did brilliantly on the most important thing you can do in a public health emergency. They really did exceptionally well. So I'm optimistic that we'll come through this and we won't need to have Sajid Javid eat his words. It's going to be, in terms of, even in a worst-case scenario, excess mortality, not be anything like the first and second waves. In fact, it'll probably, by the end of the year, feel like we had a bad flu season. That analogy was used a lot last year wrongly. Now I think it's right. The future of COVID is like what happened to influenza. Remember, influenza produced the biggest pandemics of the 20th century. The 1918-19 so-called Spanish flu was 10 times worse in terms of the share of the world's population that it killed than COVID could possibly be. Subsequently, there was no post-influenza period. People talked all the time, the post-pandemic. It's like saying post-influenza. There isn't going to be a post-COVID period when COVID obligingly goes away. It will be like influenza. It will go from being a catastrophe, which it was in the case of influenza early in the 20th century, to something that we don't actually talk terribly much about. The flu shot, the COVID shot, it becomes part of normality and not something that fundamentally disrupts your life. The key point that Doom makes is that people die. We have to deal with that. Sometimes I heard people talk last year as if death itself was really an unforgivable mistake by President Trump. In truth, even last year, COVID was not the top killer in the United States. It came third after cancer and heart disease. So it will become part of our normality. And that, I think, is fine. That's a good outcome. The one thing that worries me is that the restrictions and regulations that have come into existence over the past 18 months will persist long after the public health emergency has really ended. And that's something that concerns me a lot, because I see the inertia in the system already. There are many, many more people paid to devise regulations governing quarantines in Wales, where I just was for 11 days, than are paid to get rid of those restrictions when they're no longer necessary. Our biggest problem is going to be escaping from a set of behaviours, both in the public and private sector, that will be redundant. I fear form filling every time we fly, long after it's really productive, rather in the way that security measures after 9/11 became more theatre than actual prevention of terrorism. So I think that's a different point. My sense is that we get normality in terms of public health, but I'm not sure we necessarily get normality in terms of all the restrictions that have come into being, because there are clear bureaucratic forces that will try to keep them in place, even when they're not really serving any function.
Now, I have some rapid-fire questions from the reaction team and others, but just before that, I was going to ask you a really gloomy question, which I'm not going to ask you.
I'm being cheerful now, but it's as cheerful as I get.
It is a good news story, but as a doer, Scott, I was going to ask you about whether this fits into a sort of bigger narrative about the West and about us being humbled, really, since what happened. We win the Cold War, liberal democracy triumphs, capitalism triumphs. Then you get 9/11, and we have a lesson in hubris in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan, financial crisis, and then now this, where a lot of our major governments respond poorly. But I'm not going to ask you that question.
If you did, I would give you a really optimistic response, which is that this has been much more disastrous for China than most people in the West realise, and that the West has actually done, on balance, much better than seemed plausible a year ago. I actually think when we fast forward 10 years, and let's do a little bit of crystal ball gazing, the crisis that is going to develop in China, which has been often predicted, I mean, I wish I had a Bitcoin for every article I've read predicting the collapse of China over the last 20 years, but actually now one can see real problems developing that could be systemic and could undermine the stability of the regime. This has been a huge blow to the economy. The demographic situation has got significantly worse, and their international position is really very isolated now. I mean, they have really lost friends and alienated people over the last 18 months, including in Europe, where I think the scales have fallen from many people's eyes about the nature of the regime.
It's not a great brand at the moment, is it?
It's a terrible brand. And remember, Xi Jinping's promise, we'll save the world with our not only our personal protective equipment, but our vaccines, has turned very sour. The countries that bought the vaccines and rapidly distributed them, like Chile, for example, are finding that they don't work. Their efficacy is really low against not just the Delta variant, but other variants. I'm actually an optimist on that issue.
Yeah.
I think if one just looks ahead 10 years, the crisis in China is the story to look for, not the crisis in the West.
And also, I mean, I thought in Michael Lewis's book on the pandemic, which is told as a story of Western disaster and incompetence, actually the thing which comes through are the people further down in the system who fought back and who organized and improvised responses at a state level. It was actually a vindication of freedom and the power of innovation. Yep. But there are great opportunities, aren't there? I mean, it's not, in terms of the West, technology, innovation, changing the way that we work, space, exploration. If we get the democratic fundamentals, it's not preordained that life in the West in the next sort of 20, 30 years, or thinking particularly of Britain, is destined to go backwards.
Well, one of the things that motivates you at Reaction is trying to make the argument for not just democracy, but free markets and the rule of law, the foundations on which an open society rests. And I think if you look at the success of the vaccines, that's a terrific advertisement for our system, because the great breakthroughs came from companies like Moderna in the US and BioNTech in Germany, that are absolutely classic pioneering innovative companies That we were able to translate mRNA technology very rapidly into vaccines with above 90% efficacy and then distribute them was a tremendous tribute to the superiority of this system to be contrasted with this highly centralized Chinese system, which is still the totalitarian model of the mid-20th century and produced a great many vaccines that don't work very well, which, by the way, was predictable. And I said in Doom, if you look at China's track record of vaccines, it's really not good. So it wasn't, to me, surprising. I'm an optimist in that sense, Ian. Mm-hmm. I actually think when we step back and look over the 18 months that we've just gone through, the story that was being told last year, including to some extent by Michael Lewis, that this is a terrible indictment of Western institutions, is downright wrong. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible indictment of one-party states, because let's face it, this wouldn't have happened if they had not lied their way through December and January until it was spread just about everywhere. It was only in 23rd January that the lockdown was imposed. So I honestly think the narrative's the other way around, and that we may be selling ourselves short on both sides of the Atlantic, that the relative decentralization, for example, of the United States and the greater decentralization of Europe that Brexit has brought about turns out to be quite a good thing. And that shouldn't surprise us, because in the network age, there really can't be a future for a one-party state that seeks to restore the totalitarian model of Stalin and Mao. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you going to bet on that model in the 21st century? It seems highly unlikely to me that it's going to work out.
Yeah. So some great rapid-fire questions from the reaction team. Matty Brignall asks, which year in the 20th century changed the course of history most dramatically and why?
Which year in the 20th century? Yeah. 1917. 1917 is the key year, because although the First World War was significant in terms of loss of life, its greatest significance came from the revolution that it enabled, that would not have succeeded but for the war. And Lenin's victory produces hundreds, well, tens, if not 100 million deaths in the course of the subsequent century. So I think it has to be 1917.
And simultaneously, it's around that time that America becomes essentially the financial leader of the West.
And fails to end the war, as Phil Zelikow points out in his recent book, The Road Less Traveled.
Yeah.
I'm giving short answers as I was... By the way, if you're wondering why we're not taking questions from the audience, it is that there's a new regulation that says roving microphones are not permitted in theatres on the grounds that they are likely to spread SARS-CoV-2.
Everyone stay safe. It's for your own...
Don't touch the microphone until it's been plunged in Lysol.
The microphone of doom. So a couple of questions on China. Jerry Malone asks, you recently reviewed what seemed like every book that's ever been written on China for the TLS. Can Taiwan breathe a sigh of relief at not being invaded on the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party, or would that be premature?
The Taiwan crisis is going to be a huge test of nerve, because Taiwan is simultaneously Cuba, Berlin, and the Persian Gulf in Cold War I. It's got everything. And it's very significant that today we're hearing a shift in the Japanese position that will provide military support in the event of a Chinese invasion. That is a game changer. I think already the risk-averse people around Xi Jinping are saying, boss, I don't think we can do this. With the Japanese taking a less ambiguous position, the risks become very, very great indeed. So I think if there is a Taiwan crisis, there's a significant chance that China fails. And if it's successful, whether it's with a blockade or an invasion, there's a significant chance that it can be reversed. So I think watch this space. Taiwan is a huge deal. By the way, it's a place that we should all visit. I think Taipei is one of the really interesting cities in the world. Watching the Chinese do democracy is very impressive, and it shows how broken and wrong the model on the mainland is. I'm a massive fan of the way that the Taiwanese run their country. And I think it's extremely important that not only the United States, but its allies get behind Taiwan. If we'd actually copied Taiwan last year, rather than copying the People's Republic of China, which is what the other Neil Ferguson basically wanted us to do. By the way, I'm not him.
If you came to hear the epidemiologist...
We made that very clear.
It's not him. That's why my parents spelt my name the weird way. I never understood that. It's like, Mom, this is so difficult. I'm always having to explain the spelling. But I now understand why they did that. But the other Neil Ferguson said in an interview recently, we weren't sure we could do the Chinese
and
method.
And we were then inspired
here.
By...
Yeah. And I'm like, wait, you wanted to use the techniques of a communist regime when we could have copied the Taiwanese, who had the least restrictive measures. If you look at the Blavatnik Stringency Index, Taiwan in 2020 has the least restrictions on personal freedom. That's the China we should be learning from.
Relationship between China, and this is from Olivia, between China and Russia is becoming an increasing concern, but does Biden have the ability, diplomatic ability, to drive a wedge between Russia and China?
You know, it's a very unnatural state of affairs that Russia is so close to China and prepared to play second fiddle. But if you think that Vladimir Putin will help Xi Jinping, if Xi Jinping gets into a war with the United States, you don't understand Russian history. One of Stalin's masterstrokes was getting China to fight the Korean War for him. Mm-hmm. I think that Putin is very happy to be close to China, but he will not do anything to help China if they get into any difficulties. So no, I don't really worry about that. Ultimately, it's totally unnatural. It won't last. The threat posed to Russia's backyard by Chinese expansion, by Belt and Road and other initiatives is too obviously threatening. It's too obviously a profound threat to Russia's strategic interests. So I presume that at some point this marriage of convenience ends in divorce.
So the final question actually is from me. And you're brilliant at what you...
I thought you were going to ask me if England were going to win tomorrow night. Surely we come... We have to come to important things like football.
Thank goodness we didn't book the Garrick for tomorrow night.
8 p.m. Yeah. That would have been just you and me.
Exactly. But I was going to ask you, brilliant at what you do. You clearly love it and you're driven. Is there... And we were talking about it a bit before we came on stage. Is there humour in history on the basis that... I think Woody Allen described comedy as tragedy plus time. Do you find yourself amused by the ridiculous? I mean, you study financial crises like I do, I mean, which can be very damaging but are simultaneously highly amusing just for what they reveal about human foibles.
I do suffer from gallows humour, which I think is a Glaswegian pathology. To make jokes about that which is tragic is a way of dealing with it.
Yeah.
When I was researching the book, I suddenly remembered a song which goes like this, and I've always wanted to sing on stage, so you may want
Garrick Theatre is yours.
You may want to put your face mask over your ears at this point. The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling? Oh, grave, thy victory. And I was interested to know where that song came from. And the answer is, it was a parody of a Salvation Army song, hymn, sung by British soldiers on the Western Front on the eve of the Battle of the Somme. Now, that ability to laugh in the face of death, I admire hugely, because the probability of being killed or wounded in the first day of the Somme was extremely high. And reading the letter from a young officer who survived the Somme, in fact was decorated, describing the song and his father's reflections on its significance was one of the most moving parts of writing the book. I'm attracted to history partly by irony. If you've ever read Gibbon, and you should, The Decline and Fall is full of humor. It's full of that waspish, ironical wit that the 18th century was very good at. And I think Doom is a book written at least in an attempt to recapture that spirit. The title is ironical. I fully failed to understand that Americans wouldn't get that. And I should know by now. The book I should have written this year was Fun, The Politics of Partying, and I would have a massive bestseller on my hands. Because nobody wants to read a book about doom because they're assuming it's going to be very gloomy. Actually, the book is not. The central point about the book is that the end of the world has been predicted innumerable times, and here we are, like Daniel Defoe says at the end of his Journal of the Plague Year. And our ability to laugh in the face of catastrophe is a very human thing that I
that I admire and I aspire to when confronted with the minor disasters that occasionally beset me. I mean, in the end, this has felt like a huge disaster. It's not over, that is for sure. Globally, it's certainly not over. But at this point, the death toll is 0.05% of the population of the world. The Black Death may have killed about a third of living humans, as far as we can estimate. The Spanish influenza was like 1.7 to 2%. This is not one of history's really big disasters. Mm. If you compare it with wars, it's the Korean War. It's not World War I or World War II. So Doom is an ironical book, and I found myself drawn to some of those great moments in British humor when our finest comedians confront death, the death sequence in The Meaning of Life. And one of my favorites, which I grew up with, Peter Coop, Dudley Moore, Alan Bennett, and Jonathan Miller's End of the World from Beyond the Fringe. If younger people in the audience, if you haven't listened to Beyond the Fringe, the original Edinburgh Fringe show, you've missed out on one of the treasures of British humor. And there they sit on the top of the mountain, expecting the end of the world. And Peter Cook is the prophet. And Dudley Moore asks the wonderful question, "Will this wind be so mighty as to lay low the mountains of the earth?" And Peter Cook says, "No, it won't be quite that mighty." And so they count down, 10, 9, 8, 7, to the end of the world. "Oh, well, same time again next week, chaps. We'll get a winner sooner or later." And that's a great point that they made there. Doom, the end of the world, is something that we're very fascinated by. That's why the climate change movement has so much power, not so much because it's making a statement about the scientific probabilities of rising global temperatures and extreme weather events. It's because the end of the world is coming in 12 years. Actually, it's 10 years now, because AOC said that 2 years ago. And that's something that our human imaginations can't resist. The end of the world is a really fascinating prospect. Full-blown doom. And the point about the book is that it doesn't come. We survive.
We survive. It's a fascinating book. Thank you very much for writing it. And thank you for taking the time with us this evening. It's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you very much, Neil Ferguson.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
That was Professor Neil Ferguson in conversation with me, Ian Martin. This was a special edition of the Reaction podcast, recorded live at the Garrick Theatre in July for Reaction subscribers. To become a subscriber, go to our website. This Reaction podcast was produced by Francesca Peacock.